So we've been examining the Chula Veda Sutta. This is Sutta number 44. And in the middle way, this course is, this comments on, starts on page 396. Okay, so in the previous class, we dealt with the nature of what is called Sakkaya, that's identity, which is the five aggregates, the collection of the five aggregates, and then with the relationship between the five aggregates of clinging and clinging itself. Okay, so that takes us through halfway down on page 397. And now we come to the important topic of what is called identity view. In Pali, this is called Sakkaya Identity. So this is a particular kind of view or perspective regarding Sakkaya. Okay, so Sakkaya are the five aggregates subject to clinging. So what are the five aggregates? We can't call on the person who knows the name of the wives of the Asuras. Somebody else. Okay. Oh, I'm reading from a book. No. Material form, feeling, perception, the mental formations or volitional activities, and consciousness. And so identity view is the kind of view regarding these five aggregates. And it's particularly the view, in a general way we can express it as the view which identifies one or another of the five aggregates as being oneself, or which in some way holds to the idea of a self existing in relation to the five aggregates. That's the more general way to characterize identity view. But the text is going to explain it in somewhat more detailed or more elaborate way. So you can look at the text. So remember, this is a dialogue between the bhikkhuni, Dhammadina, and her former husband, who is the lay follower of Visakha. So Visakha asks, "Lady, how, or venerable lady, how does identity view come to be?" And then Dhammadina explains, "Here, an untaught, ordinary person, or we might say an uninstructed, worldly person, who has no regard for the noble ones and is unspeakable, teaching, who has no regard for the true, and maybe more generally, the true persons or good persons, the saintly persons. This, again, it means the noble ones, and who is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma, regards material form as self, or self as possessed of material form. Or in other words, self is the owner of material form. Or material form as existing inside the self, or the self as existing inside material form. And similarly, he regards feeling as the self. He regards perception as the self. He regards the mental formations as the self. He regards consciousness as the self, or self as possessing consciousness, or consciousness as existing in the self, or the self as existing in consciousness. So what identity view eventually turns out to be 20 kinds, 20 views, 20 possible views regarding the five aggregates. And so we have five aggregates, and each of these aggregates can be regarded in one of four ways. We can put this in kind of an algebraic form. Some of these might seem a little bit strange to us, but probably in India during the Buddha's time, there were a lot of different schools of philosophy, religious thought beginning to evolve, which presented different ideas about the self. And they tried to find different ways to establish a relationship between what they believe to be the self and the visible, concrete, individual personality or individual being. So, like, the simplest way to go about establishing the idea or view of self is to identify myself is X. Myself is bodily form. Myself is feeling. Myself is perception. Myself is volitional activities. Myself is consciousness. And last week I spoke about how, again, I'm going to say that this is my personal interpretation. It doesn't come from any authorized Buddhist text. But it seems that people with different characters, different interests, will incline to identify with one or another of the five aggregates. So the beauty queen or the sports muscle man, they will identify more with the body. formed as a self. A person with very refined aesthetic temperament, or somebody who likes to wallow feelings and emotions, will identify self with feeling. Somebody who is maybe an artist, or can be even a computer programmer, who likes to work with ideas, concepts, systems of ideas, might identify perception as the self. The person of action, a business executive, politician, military man, they would be the type to identify with volitions as the self. And then the thinker, the philosopher, or maybe the mystic will identify with consciousness as the self. So that's some simplest level, is to identify one or another of the aggregates as the self. But another way of thinking about the self is to see the self as something standing apart from the five aggregates, and then to conceive of the self as being that which possesses or owns the aggregates. So we can see how this is reflected in our ordinary language. We say, this is my body. And so ordinarily, we don't inquire into the implications of that idea. We just take it for granted. It's somewhat, you know, something that just works, and the background of the mind is a tacit assumption, kind of underlying presupposition. So we're always thinking, my body, after you wake up in the morning, if you look in the mirror, then you have to make sure everything looks beautiful, right? Even we monks, we have to think, it's my, or my whiskers is getting too long, or shave. We think, I have my robe on properly. So this is my body. But usually you don't formulate it in that way, but it just remains there quietly in the background of the mind. But if you go to the doctor, he says, oh, your cardiogram shows defective heart. Oh, then the idea of grasping at my body comes very clearly to the surface. Oh, I have a weak heart. Oh, am I going to live? Am I going to die? Do I need a heart transplant? Oh, your liver is failing. Again, it's my liver, my body. And so when there's some kind of affliction that attacks the body, then you can see the idea, myself as the owner of the body, becomes explicit, rises to the surface. And similarly, if somebody speaks a little bit rudely or impolitely to us, we think, or we might say to them, oh, you hurt my feelings. So here we're identifying with feelings. So the idea that I own, or actually we're identifying as the owner of the feelings. He hurt my feelings. So if you don't apologize to me, I'm not going to speak to you anymore. So my feelings have been hurt. Or else if we touch like a hot stove, we get ill with flu, that we're really feeling miserable, then we think, ah, these are my feelings. Again, if we have some idea, like in a classroom, teacher calls on you, and you present some idea, and then the teacher or other students reject that idea and say, that is my perception, which is being rejected. A And so here the identification, the taking of the perception for ideas to be oneself, taking oneself to be the owner of the perceptions, this is becoming explicit. That if one makes a proposal for a project, for a way of doing things, a project for organizing a committee, project for promoting Buddhism, okay, and then somebody rejects that proposal, then we could say my volition, my will, my purpose, my intention is being rejected. Okay, so these are different ways in which the idea of taking things to be mine comes to the surface. In the third proposition, X existing in the self, this is more philosophical, and this seems to be a rather, not so common in the West, but it was rather becoming widespread idea in India during the time of the Buddha, that the self is something vast, immeasurable, universal, and everything in the world exists within self. So this is a view that's often expressed in a collection of texts called the Upanishads, one of the important texts, the foundations of Indian thought. And so the fundamental idea of the Upanishads is that the real self, our real self, is a imperceptible, invisible, all-embracing, universal reality, and that the whole world exists within the self. And so everything in the world passes away and vanishes, but the self always remains eternal, unchanging, immutable. So here we have everything, including the five aggregates, existing in the self. And then the fourth idea, it's an idea that, again, we might not formulate very explicitly, but sometimes if we reflect, we have the idea that there must be something inside me, behind all the activities of the senses, behind my experiences of feeling, something which is the feeler of feelings, the perceiver of perceptions, the doer of actions, the knower, that which is even behind consciousness. And so we take the self to be existing inside the five aggregates, to be the inner nucleus or inner substance of a person. So it's like peeling away fruit. Maybe it's like cutting through a peach, and then inside the peach one finds the pit. And so the pit, you can say, is the essence of the peach. Yeah, it's actually very, that's a good point. It's very much like the idea in maybe Christianity or in other forms of theism of the individual soul as something existing within us. In fact, also in Hinduism, one has the idea of the self as something existing deep within, behind all the layers of body and mind. So they speak in also in the Upanishads of five sheets or coverings of the self. There's physical or bodily covering, the covering of prana or vital energy, the covering of manu, which is mind, mental activity, intellect, the covering of vijnana, which is knowing or consciousness, and then then there's a fifth sheath, which is called the sheath of bliss, Ananda Kosha, Anandamaya Kosha, the blissful sheath. And then behind or within the blissful sheath is the Atman, the eternal self. So the Buddha speaks about these as views which are held by the uninstructed, ordinary person, one who has not seen and realized the Dharma. And this factor of, or this, yeah, this factor of identity view becomes extremely important in the Buddhist system of teaching. For what reasons? Very important reason. Yeah. Of course that's important too, but there's specifically the Sakkaya Ditti or identity view plays a key role with the Buddha's teaching. This one question that came from the internet person asked, in my example of attachment to the aggregate, who or what becomes attached to the aggregate? Okay, this is an important question. And actually, the question says, who or what? And if we take who to be what is attaching, then we're holding to a view of self of some kind. thinking that there's a self which is attached to the aggregate. But according to the Buddha's teaching, there's no self which is attached to the aggregate, but there is just this attachment or clinging to the five aggregates. And that clinging to the five aggregates is one included within one of the five aggregates. It's in the aggregate of volitional formations, of volitional activities. So clinging is a particular mental disposition or mental factor, and this clinging, this clinging is what becomes attached to the body, your form, feeling, perception, volitional activities, and consciousness. And so because of that clinging, there appears to the mind the idea that I am a self, or I have a self. And then if we speculate about the five aggregates, then we think that the self exists within the five aggregates, owning the five aggregates, and so on. If there's no actual self that stands outside the five aggregates and becomes attached to them, it's just that the clinging gives rise to this delusion or appearance of a self.
Enables us to mediate between our own needs and the world for
meaningful relations with other people. Okay, so that would be the wholesome or strong sense of, I use the word ego, though it has negative connotations, but this would be maybe the sense of oneself as a person, as a true individual.
Ego doesn't necessarily have a negative connotation.
Excuse me?
Ego doesn't necessarily have a negative connotation.
Yeah, but the way it's used in popular, maybe in the psychological literature it doesn't, but in popular usage, like people will say he has too much ego, or he's an egomaniac, or he's carried away by his own ego. So this would be like the negative side of the sense of self-identity. And so in ordinary people, both sides develop together. And to be a healthy person, the negative side of ego has to be kept sort of under control, and the positive side has to be strengthened and enhanced. But normally, in all individuals, except those who have reached some of the stages of enlightenment, there's some idea of oneself as having this self, which one then either identifies with some aspect of one's the body-mind complex, or else one views as existing behind or within the body-mind complex. And then that becomes the basis for clinging to the sense of what truly am. Then for the Buddha, that is like one of the root causes of dukkha, of suffering.
Stories
based on the sequencing of thoughts, interwoven with feelings, ideas, plans, desires, memories, and all of this, these different strands or threads get woven together to make up the fabric of our individual identity. And so through the practice of insight meditation, through what applies mindfulness and clear comprehension to whatever arises, simply notes it and lets it go. So feelings arise, we'll just note the feeling, let it go. Ideas will arise, what notes them, lets them go. Plans, memories, desires, projects arise, again, one notes them, lets them go. And then one can turn even to the, what I could call the light of awareness itself, and just observe that light of awareness. And so in this way, one is step by step disidentifying with each of these factors of our experience. And by objectifying it, labeling it, one steps back from it and doesn't get carried away by it. Then as one goes on observing in this way, one begins to see what I would call the flow or flux-like nature of experience. That what we call experience is not the experience of a lasting subject, the lasting entity, but it's a constant succession of occasions of feeling, perception, willing, and knowing, all based upon a physical body, which is also in a process of change. And so through this kind of mindful self-observation, one comes to recognize the mark of impermanence, that all of the factors of experience arise and pass away, arise and pass away. And then as one is seeing them arise and pass away, then one is beginning to get a clear perception of impermanence and Nietzsche. And as the concentration and mindfulness grows stronger, this perception of impermanence penetrates through to deeper and deeper levels, or subtler and subtler levels, until one is able to see the impermanence of the bodily processes, even at what we might call a molecular or atomic level. It doesn't mean that it's actually perceiving atoms, but the speed at which things are arising and passing away intensifies so much that it seems even within a second, one is able to observe dozens or even hundreds of events of arising and passing away. And similarly with the mind, the mental activity, if one turns the focus of attention on the mental activity, one sees what seem to be dozens or even hundreds of acts of mind arising and passing away moment by moment. And so one is getting a very clear perception of impermanence. And then from that perception of impermanence, when it carries deep enough, then one can start turning and seeing how whatever is impermanent cannot be myself. And so everything one is observing is arising and passing away. And so one gives up the identification of it as myself. And then one might think, well, even though whatever I'm observing is myself, but the observer is not myself. Whatever I am observing is not myself, but the observer is myself. So behind all of the changing experience, there seems to be some kind of lasting light of awareness, and that is the self. But what one then does is to, what I call it, bend the light of attention back upon the awareness itself, And then one sees how the awareness is also always arising and passing away. And so one keeps on doing this with each level of reflective awareness. And so one sees both sides of the experience, the objective portion and the subjective portion, arising and passing, arising and passing. Because they're both arising and passing, then one cannot think of as self. So eventually, as one develops this insight into the selfless nature of the aggregates, instead that one reaches a certain point where one fully penetrates through all the selfless nature of all conditioned phenomena, and then momentarily realizes the unconditioned, which doesn't arise, that which doesn't arise and pass away. And when one makes a breakthrough, it's called a breakthrough to the truth of the Dhamma, then the idea of self falls away completely. And at that point, the fetter of identity view was broken. Okay, any questions on this portion of the sutta? This is a question, is it possible for the mind, let's say for a person to have sexual desire or ill will if one has totally eliminated the view of self? Yes, that is possible. Because the view of self, it's a kind of cognitive idea. And so the person who breaks through the view of self completely or eliminates the view of self completely is what we call the stream entering. This is a person who's reached the first stage of awakening, the first stage of enlightenment. But this person hasn't yet eliminated all of the mental fetters or afflictions. And so even a person who's a stream enterer, or even at the next level, the once returner, can still have sensual desire, ill will, though of course they'll be weaker than that than an undeveloped person. But it's only at the third of the four stages of enlightenment that sexual desire and ill will are eliminated. Okay, this gets a little complicated. I often hear people say the Buddha actually never said that there isn't a self. He only said to see things is not self. Can you comment on this? Yes, this is actually true. It's actually true. The Buddha doesn't say explicitly there is no self. So it's in a way to say there is no self is to set up something like a theoretical position. So the Buddha always takes a very practical approach. At least this is the way I understand it. What he says is to contemplate or to observe all phenomena as non-self. So the root of the problem is that we identify things as being I and mine. And usually what we identify as being I or mine are the five aggregates. So the Buddha's way of instruction is to point out that the five aggregates are not the self and not the belongings of the self. And so see, contemplate the five aggregates as not mine, not I, not the self. So that's what we call the practical approach of the Buddha. Okay. Would the Buddhist mind-only school or the school of Buddha nature have the view that all existence position that X exists in the self. Self-nature generates all existences in the platform sutra, that is the sutra of Huineng. It seems to me that all schools of Buddhism that I know of reject the view of self. But sometimes the language in the mind-only school can seem a little bit similar to that of the language in Upanishads or Vedanta. But at least explicitly they are committed to the idea that all phenomena are non-self. I'm in no way an expert on this particular school, so I can't comment authoritatively on it. Okay, please.
I have a question, and a general question.
Yeah.
When you're referring, as you said, to the cognitive view of self,
yeah,
regressing the cognitive views, regressing,
yeah,
things, but speaking as a mother, yeah, who is present at the birth of the baby, it seems to be the case that there is a primal view of self that exists right from the moment of birth.
You see in the infant.
In yeah, human beings. And yeah, what I observed, to quote D.W. Monica, for example, that a mother's job is to bear the rage of the infant. There's a rage for life,
yeah,
and a grasping,
yeah,
at life that appears with the first breath.
Yeah.
And it is, in a sense, there only seem to be selfless when everything is going your way.
Yeah, so it's non-cognitive, so it's not really like a view of, an explicit view of self. But what I would say is that the tendency to the idea of I is there. And so if it's frustrated or countered in any way, then it gets activated.
Yeah, and this grasping is, yeah, very, very fierce. Start speaking, yeah, as the object of the grasp.
I guess it depends on the child. Maybe there are some infants who are very calm. Maybe an infant who's been a yogi in a previous life. There's, you know, stories that I've read about how maybe these are people who become saints later in life, but they come out all the relatives standing around are very astonished at how calm and tranquil the baby is. Nothing seems to disturb the baby. Yeah, okay. Did you have a comment? Maybe take the microphone.
I was just thinking that in order to get to the point of accepting kind of non-self, one would have to be much older. You know, it's a kind of complex notion.
Yeah.
Because I think the more natural state is to experience a self.
Yeah.
One would not be able to experience a non-self until one had developed cognitively, you know, to make that kind of,
yeah,
separation. So
yeah,
you couldn't really have anybody until, let's say, the middle of their adolescence begin to deal with it. Adolescence is very self-involved.
Well, I think by middle of adolescence, already the idea of self is, especially in America, clearly solidly established. Maybe not in a reflective way, but certainly in a way that's in an operative way. I was going to say something. I think it was relating to the idea of the cognitive self. It doesn't necessarily mean that the person has a philosophical view of the self. It's actually sort of sitting down at his desk with paper, a notebook, and a pen, and writing. When I reflect deeply in myself, I can see how of such children, but certainly that which knows, that which thinks, that must be the self. Not necessarily in that case, but it just means that the idea of the self is formed to the extent that one tends to identify explicitly in one's thinking with things, in one's day-to-day interactions with other people and the world. And then, yeah, the other point that I wanted to bring up when you were speaking about the need to have the idea of self in order to overcome it, that there are two ways in which, you could say, people have an undeveloped idea of self, or maybe two ways in which people can operate without a developed idea of self. One is people who have an underdeveloped idea of self. These would be people who are maybe subject to schizophrenia or to what are some of the other conditions? Yeah, but there are people who could even be well-developed intellectually, not mentally retarded, but there's still not a complete, like, healthy unification or solidification of the personality. And so for that person, a person like that, it's usually said that this type of Buddhist philosophy of non-self or meditation on non-self is not recommended. Because what that person has to do is to overcome this dissolution. To overcome this ununified aspect of the personality, this multiple personality or unsolidified aspect of personality, and consolidate it more in order to develop a healthy sense of self. Okay, so in order to reach, to be able to cultivate the insight into non-self, one first needs a healthy and well-developed sense of self. And then when one overcomes the idea of the atta, the self spoken of in Buddhism, then one becomes free from self in the healthy or wholesome way. That's what's special at hand. So, Neil? Take the other.
The previous, one of the questions from online got me thinking, if the Buddha actually never said there is no self,
yeah,
but instead encouraged one not to see the aggregates as self,
yeah,
is it possible that he meant to say, these are not self, but something else is?
No, because he also repeatedly rejects somebody's attempt to posit a self outside or beyond the aggregates. I think one can, what I would say is that one can infer from things that the Buddha said that he doesn't accept the idea of a metaphysical self at all. I think Andrea, what's this?
Thanks for bringing that up, because everyone, there's like a whole internet debate, just raging debate. People who are hysterical, I mean, really hysterical in their arguments, and they use that to even further posit the idea of self by saying, well, he never said that.
Yeah.
So I wanted you to clarify that, so I
understand. Yeah, I keep away. I keep away from internet debates.
This is going to get on the internet. That's important to me. I wanted you to go over there further, because I could just...
Well, they think I understand it.
Yeah, wow. Extremely careful of everything I say here.
And then we come up into the jungle, because they just go into the nutters over that. So ergo, if it's a fact that there must be a soul or an atma.
Yeah.
But next is a great rebirth today for us.
A person asks the Buddha if there is a self.
Yeah.
And so the Buddha
was saying like on bad aggregates, how can you still think there is a self? It's something like that.
I know next to nothing about all of this because I'm just very beginner. But I'm wondering if all of this is somehow, it sounds to me, anyway, in Robert Morris's perception, this whole thing is to sound very metaphorical. Even the idea of self sounds as if he's talking about something in some metaphorical kind of way rather than some literal kind of way. And we're talking about all of this in a very literal sense. There is a self that he was talking about self. Perhaps he was talking about something somewhat different. I don't know what that would be, but it doesn't sound as, you know, as if something that's literal that exists in the way that he was talking about.
Well,
I'm not making myself clear.
Unless he was,
I mean, there is a self. There is this self. It goes back and forth.
Well, that is just one of the questions, or one of the questions that was discussed and debated amongst all the thinkers and religious teachers of the Buddha's time. And then the Buddha spoke about this whole debate that there is a self, there isn't a self. He calls it like the wilderness of views, the desert of views, the thicket of views. But the idea of, for people who have the idea of self, including those on the internet who say there is no self, you idiot. Okay, this is on page 232. It's Sutta number 22, paragraph number 25. Okay, the Buddha is speaking to a monk, and he says, or to the monks, and he says, because their being a self, when they're being for me, what belongs to a self. In other words, if there is a self, then there's something which belongs to a self. That would be, if I posit a self, I'm going to say the five aggregates belong to the self, or external things literally belong to the self. Okay, so the monk says yes. Then the Buddha says, or else, if there is what belongs to a self, then would there be for me a self? So yes. So in other words, self and what belongs to a self are interdependent notions. Then he says, since a self and what belongs to a self are not apprehended or not found as true and established, then the standpoint for views, namely that which is the self, is the world, after death I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, and so on, doesn't that become an utterly and completely foolish teaching? Okay, so the point that I want to make here is that the Buddha doesn't quite say that since a self and what belongs to a self doesn't exist, you know, he just puts aside the question of existence. And he says a self and what belongs to a self are not apprehended. They're not discovered, not found as true and established. So then that becomes a reason for putting aside all views of self. Okay.
But there's no entity which is the carrier of the karma.
But other schools weren't satisfied with that, and some posited a kind of consciousness that's called the Alaya Vijnana, which is, again, is a stream rather than a lasting entity, but it's a stream that continues on preserving its identity from life to life, and it carries the seeds of karma. Okay, this is just a continuation of the question. Okay, I think we'll end now, and we will have a class again next Saturday, the 29th, and we'll try to finish the sutta next week. I thought myself this morning, well, I should be able to finish the sutta today. But I think it's important to discuss the questions that arise from this passage. Okay, we'll end with the sharing of the notes. We share the merits of listening to the Dhamma, teaching the Dhamma. We share that with the devas, the Buddhas or fear spirits, and other sentient beings. Sadhana Sampati Siddhya Bhagavad Gita.